No, 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 it's fine. And then I. Okay, thank you. And so we are going to call to order. Public hearing. Script here, here we go. All right, so today is Wednesday, February 22nd, 2017. We're going to call to order the meeting on Senate Committee on Workforce. Thank you, everyone, for coming today. We are going to talk today about pay equity, and I appreciate everyone here to get this very important everyone coming to get this important subject going. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 752, and I'm going to ask Deborah here to summarize the bill, please.
Thank you, Chair Taylor. SB 752 expands the protection against discrimination in the payment of compensation based on sex to other protected classes. It prohibits employers from screening or determining compensation of applicants based on current or past compensation. It prohibits employers from seeking applicant salary history before making an employment offer. It clarifies that unequal pay for substantially similar work is permissible when based on systems of seniority, merit, or production quantity, or on bona fide job-related factors based on business necessity. It clarifies that amounts owed to the employee in violation of the pay equity provisions constitute unpaid wages. It expands available remedies to include compensatory and punitive damages. It establishes that violation occurs each time unequal wages are paid. It allows all employees 1 year from discovery of violation to bring an action. It protects workers' seniority following use of sick time or family leave. There is one amendment posted on OLIS, the dash one, as disability to the list of protected classes.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Senator Dembro, who's one of the sponsors of the bill, was supposed to testify today. He could not be here, but I just wanted to go ahead and say that on the record. I'm going to go ahead and call some folks up. We're going to start with our House Majority Leader, Jennifer Williamson, and we'll at the same time bring up Representative Lively and Representative Leininger. Let's give you together. My lovely friends from the House, thank you so much for coming today.
Isn't the House a nice place?
It's such a nice place. But here we are. Here we are, stuck with us. So go ahead, whichever order you want, of course.
Thank you, Chair Taylor and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger, State Representative for House District 38, which is Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland. We really appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 752, which helps address a problem that is still a big problem. This panel is going to help frame the issue, and then we're going to move immediately with the at the pleasure of the chair into some subject matter experts who can offer lived experience and also some assistance in providing our interpretation of the bill. I just want to note that this is still a real problem, not just in Oregon, but around the country. And there are several high-profile examples that I want to draw to your attention. The U.S. Women's National Soccer Team brought in more revenue and won more games than the men's team in 2015, but it was paid substantially less, and the women were given smaller per diems and sponsor appearances. Just one example. In Silicon Valley, in 2015, men with a degree in Silicon Valley earned between 52% and 61% more than women with the same level of education. In journalism, journalists at the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and Market Watch at the end of 2015, men earned 13.5% more than women who were at the same level. So in a breadth of disciplines, this continues to be a problem around our country and here. The bill that we have developed with leadership from Senator Dembro, and which we support, and which there's a parallel version moving forward in the House, it does two key things. One is it strengthens protections under existing law to prevent pay discrimination in employment, and two, it clarifies rules. It clarifies rules applicable to employers, which will make it easier both for employers and employees, because it will be more clear the circumstances under which differentiated pay is okay, what constitutes pay, and a range of other things. So the clarity is something of benefit both to workers and employers. With that, I'd like to turn it over to our majority leader, Representative Williamson.
Thank you. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Williamson. I represent House District 36 in Portland, and today I'm testifying on Senate Bill 752 on behalf of an inspiring Oregonian who can't be here today. Becky Sauerbrunn is the co-captain of the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, an Olympic gold medalist, a Women's World Cup champion, captain of the FC Kansas, and I am proud to say one of my constituents. One of the world's best defensive players, she has represented the United States at two FIFA Women's World Cups and two Summer Olympics. Becky has won two National Women's Soccer League championships and was awarded Defender of the Year for three consecutive seasons. She's been honored by President Obama at the White House, was part of the first women's sports team to be honored with a ticker tape parade and a key to the city of New York, and was among the first women players ever to be featured in a popular FIFA video game series. On top of all of these and other incredible achievements, Becky has been an outspoken advocate for equal pay for equal work. She and four of her fellow national teammates have been fighting in court against the brazen gender discrimination by U.S. soccer, both in the areas of compensation and in treatment. Despite her obligations in this ongoing dispute, the U.S. national team and her regional team, Becky took the time to write this letter to this committee. She wanted to be here today, but training started last week, so she couldn't be here today. Dear Chair Taylor, I write to voice my strong support for Oregon Senate Bill 752, which works to promote equal pay for equal work. This particular issue hits close to home for me as a player for the United States Women's National Soccer Team. For the last several years, we've been engaged in a fight to ensure the kind of pay equity that this bill would provide. In spite of our collective success as a team, including a World Cup win and a number one ranking by FIFA, the profits we earn for U.S. soccer and comparable work obligations, male players are compensated in a very different and more significant way. This issue is not just about money either. It's about the basic treatment as players compared to our male counterparts. From the type of field we play on to the way we travel, there are big differences between genders in spite of our shared employer and shared profession. Nationally, this type of gender discrimination we face is unfortunately normal. On average, women are paid 79 cents for every dollar that a man makes. And when it comes to women of color, the inequity is even larger. And factors like education still do not level the playing field. While our fight for future generations of female soccer players go on, you have an opportunity in Oregon to ensure that working women do not face the type of inequity that we do. Thank you for your consideration of this bill and for your work to ensure equal pay for equal work. Sincerely, Becky Sauerbrunn. Thank you.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. My name is John Lively. I'm from House District 12, which encompasses most of the great city of Springfield. I'm honored to be with Representative Williams and Representative Leininger today to speak about Senate Bill 752. Most of my career, in fact, 99% of my career, the 45 years I've worked, I've had the honor and privilege to be a manager, not something I started off to be, but that's what I ended up being. And during that time, I've managed operations from as small as 5 employees to 600 employees. And I was fortunate in all those years that I worked for companies and in organizations that believed in having systems in place that ensured equal treatment to employees. And so while I was involved many times in hiring of employees and unfortunately sometimes dismissing, I can assure you that in all the companies I worked for, we had pay scales and job qualifications and things, all those things in place, and hired people only based on the best persons for the job that met the requirements and other standards. But what I realized during that time, and still realize unfortunately, that that's not the case every place. One case in particular that early in my career got my attention, I have two beautiful daughters. And watching them grow up, and in some cases the treatments that they received being females versus males, even before they got in the workforce, was disturbing. But as they entered the workforce, my youngest daughter in particular had an incident. So she went through a training to be a manager, which I advised her against, but she went through the training to be a manager in this company and was well down the way of going through all the steps, working in different operations, being a assistant manager, and had met all the qualifications in that to become a manager. And when it came time for her to receive that promotion, both in pay and management, they informed her that she wouldn't be getting it, and another person in the company who was a male would be receiving that promotion and the reasons. And this was very surprising to me that the company divulged these reasons. But the reasons was, at that point, she was single, soon to be married, female, and of childbearing age, and they thought that she wouldn't be appropriate for that position at that time. She didn't stay with the company, to say the least. There was other opportunities, and I can only report today that both my daughters are very successful, and I'm glad for that. When we started discussing this bill, one of the things I did was contact in our area some of the employers, and specifically in the high-tech industry, because in Lane County, the high-tech industry is growing pretty fast. And one of the managers that I contacted in the high-tech industry, I was talking about this specific bill. And the comment he made to me was it would be problematic if they were not able to ask employees when they were interviewing about what their previous salary was, because that would create a burden in them being able to determine what to pay those employees, i.e., would we have to pay as much as we paid for the last employer, or even what their job description was. So that was concerning for me, and this is people in the industry today. Last week on KEZI in Eugene, Celeste Edmond, who's the CEO of Lunar Logic, which is a company that's been in Eugene, Springfield area for a long time, and one of only two female CEOs in the high-tech industry in Eugene, Springfield, which now has 5,000 employees, she was on TV talking about pay equity. And she reported in her company, they annually monitor the wage scales in that from a comparative standpoint to make sure that they're positioned correctly in the marketplace. And what she was saying on TV, that when they do that, one of the things that's very clear from a standpoint of female employees, especially African American or those of other ethnicity, that they're paid substantially less. In particular, for many of the positions for just females, it was 80% than what the males were making. If they were African American or other ethnicities, it was less than that. She also reported that CEOs, which there's only two of them in Lane County in the high-tech industry, females were also paid at a lesser rate than they were. So she was talking about this on TV. So the good news was, though, from her perspective, is that she told people that since she was in Oregon doing business, and she believed Oregon was a progressive state, and we'd be taking actions and doing things in the future to help address that inequity. So based on those reasons, I'm here to offer my support for this bill. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Does anybody have any questions?
I do.
Okay. Senator, come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Majority Leader. You were talking about, obviously, soccer and the disparity there. And so you were mentioning, I was unclear as to what you were referring to as it related to revenue. You mentioned that the women had more wins, and I think all of that. So I want to be clear about, was the women's soccer team bringing in more revenue than the men's?
They were more profitable than the U.S. men's team.
Well, more profitable doesn't mean necessarily more revenue. They may have been making up that profit on the lower accommodations that they were giving the women.
That's true.
I don't know. Do you happen to know if on the revenue side or on the rating side or the advertising side? You don't know?
Not.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you so much. Really appreciate you coming to testify. And then, Senator Gelser, did you want to speak now, or did you want to wait till some others came forward?
I can wait.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and call up Alana Pirtle-Ginney from Governor Brown's office. And then on deck, we should have Whitney Stark, who is an attorney with the Oregon Women's Lawyers, and we'll have Andrea Peluso and Trish Gardner be ready to come up. So those three after Alana speaks. Hello, thank you so much for coming. We know you're very busy.
Thank you for having me, Chair Taylor, and thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ilana Pirtle-Ginney. I'm here on behalf of Governor Brown. I am the governor's labor and workforce policy advisor. The governor is glad to see the legislature taking up this issue, so thank you for holding this hearing today and bringing this bill forward. The governor on numerous occasions has talked about the fact that she has actually experienced pay inequity personally, and I would guess, frankly, that everybody in this room either has or knows somebody who has experienced pay inequity. It is more common than we think. Oregon has made a significant amount of progress on this issue, and in fact, we are doing better than many states in this country. But the pay gap, even when adjusted for factors like education, and the type of work being done is persistent and it is consistent. In short, we're stuck. That gap is not getting smaller at a rate that is helping Oregonians. And the cost is too high. It's too high for our state, and it's too high for Oregon families. For us to be at our best and work at our highest capacity and raise our average wages across the state, which is a goal that we all talk about, we must close the pay gap. It's going to take another push to get there. The laws we currently have on the books clearly aren't enough to close it the rest of the way. I want to thank you on behalf of the governor again for hearing this bill today and having this conversation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great, thank you. Does anyone have any questions for Alana? Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Okay, so we're going to, I know I mentioned some folks, but we're going to change that up a little bit. We're going to have Whitney Stark come up, please. And then we'll have Andrea Peluso and from Family Forward. And then Lori Wagner, please. And we'll, let's see, do we want to have, does Trish Garner want to come up later? Do you want to come up later, or is that kind of the idea? Okay, well, we'll have there's room for three now, so we'll have you start now. Okay, thank you for coming. Appreciate it.
Good afternoon. My name is Whitney Stark. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak today. I'm an attorney. I practice employment and labor law, and I've reviewed this bill and find that it provides essential and necessary additional protections for employees. Importantly, however, it also clarifies several key issues that improve both an employer's ability to comply with the law as well as an employee's ability to enforce the law. The bill expands its protections beyond gender to additional protected classes, and that protection is significant for each of those protected classes, but it also should make the law easier to administer for an employer because any changes that it needs to or has implemented would be the same across the board instead of just on the basis of gender. And significantly, the bill would not just require equal pay for comparable work, but with the proposed changes, it would affirmatively prohibit an employer from setting compensation based on an employee's past compensation or relying on that salary history to set the salary it makes for the employee when it makes the initial offer. The bill also makes several critical clarifications. It adds to the definition of compensation to be clear that it includes all types of compensation paid to an employee, so that would include wages, bonuses, and fringe benefits. It adds a definition for work of comparable character that provides more certainty as to what type of work must be paid equally. Making the law more specific in that way ensures that employers know exactly what steps they need to take in order to comply. They're not left with guessing at vague or generalized language. So as an example, with the proposed changes in the bill, an employer can know that if it's paying wages using a system that measures a quantity of production, so like a piece rate type of payment, that does leave them in compliance with the law. And that clarification provides important certainty. Additionally, the proposed amendments explain that protected leaves of absences cannot be counted against an employee in their seniority status, which helps clarify another issue that could be confusing for both an employer and an employee. It also includes several key enforcement provisions. It expands the time period for which a public employee has to notify a public body from 6 months to 1 year. And it expands the remedies by, for example, allowing an injured employee the right to seek a jury trial. Those are very valuable rights to an injured employee. Additionally, I would like to clarify some issues that the law does not do. It does not prevent an employer from paying an employee differently based on the location that they work. The law allows an employee or employer to pay difference based on a bona fide factor other than race, gender, or protected category. So, for example, if you have an employee that's working in Medford versus Portland, and there's cost of living differences, that would be a bona fide factor you could take into account as an employer. Similarly, an employer is allowed to take into account the merit of an employee's work. So you have a consistently better performing employee, and you're doing regular performance reviews that shows that, an employer can pay somebody different based on that merit system. The law also doesn't prevent any discussions around salary desire or salary negotiations. It simply prevents an employer from asking the salary history and taking that into account when it's making its initial offer of employment. But after an initial offer of employment that includes a salary is made, an employee can negotiate a salary, and there can be continued discussions about salary. Also, before an offer is made, you can ask an employee preferred salary. You can consider market wages and other factors. The law does not change anything in the burden of proof. Makes absolutely no changes in the burden of proof from the current law. In fact, I think it makes the burden on the employer easier because it provides that additional clarity from existing law. The current law states that an employer can pay differently based on good faith factors. And that's a very difficult standard to understand, and allows a lot of wiggle room for employees to come and make arguments. But this law spells out exactly what they can and can't do, so that makes that easier. And finally, this law does not, there of course is other laws out there that are aimed at addressing discrimination, but this law does more than what the existing law does. It adds protections, for example, into inquiring about salary history. It adds protections regarding using protected leaves of absence against you, and it provides those important additional protections.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Andrea Peluso. I'm the Executive Director of Family Forward Oregon, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 752. Equal pay for equal work, as you've heard, is still a far-off reality for too many women. Wage discrimination takes many forms, but it can be seen now across all industries at all ages for working women. Accounting for all other variables, Oregon women now see a pay differential of earning about 80 cents for every dollar that men earn. This is even more marked for women of color. As you've heard, African American women are paid just 63 cents, and Latinas are paid just 54 cents for every dollar that a white man earns. This has dire consequences for women and the families that rely on them. Mothers in particular are affected by the wage gap. In fact, mothers often see a wage penalty of earning 60 cents to the dollar that fathers earn, and they're now increasingly the primary or sole breadwinners in nearly 40% of families nationwide. Here in Oregon, more than 164,000 family households are headed by women, and an incredible 30% of those families are living at incomes below the federal poverty level. Senate Bill 752, we feel, is an important step toward ending pay inequality in Oregon. It includes two important provisions that will help to ensure that all protected classes are paid equally for equal work in Oregon. As you've heard, first, it precludes employers from screening job applicants based on salary history or basing a salary decision on one's previous salary history. We believe this will help to break the cycle of pay disparity that can often trap women in wages lower than their counterparts over multiple jobs, wage gaps that compound over the course of their career and follow them from job to job. The second component of Senate Bill 752 is arguably to me the most important provision of the bill, which requires that employees are paid equally for work of comparable character. Current law in Oregon is not adequate to protect workers from pay discrimination. While we do have basic anti-discrimination provisions in civil rights law, these protections do not include the standard that workers be paid equally for work of comparable character, simply that they not be discriminated against on the basis of their protected class status. Likewise, Likewise, the current pay equity statute in Oregon wage and hour law doesn't refer to all protected classes, just pay equity between the sexes. And neither civil rights law nor wage and hour law set a standard for what work of comparable character means. That is resolved through this legislation. While we see this bill as a critical part of ending pay discrimination, we also know there's not a one policy solution to solving the wage gap. It will take a range of policies to better support women and working families to succeed in the workplace. Ending pay disparity means adding these additional protections against discrimination, expanding access to paid family and medical leave, affordable child care, and a host of other things, but we see this as an important step forward. Thank you.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, I'm pleased to have the opportunity to testify in favor of Senate Bill 752 today. Let me tell you a little bit about who I am and my business experience and why I believe this legislation is common sense for Oregon and actually makes it easier for Oregon to attract the kind of talent that we need. I went to Stanford University for my bachelor's in architecture and my master's degree in civil engineering. Go ahead.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I apologize. We just need you to say your name.
Did I not say my name?
It's okay. I know. It's awful. You sit there and we're all up here looking at you.
Know.
It's very nerve-wracking. I apologize.
Name. Backing up, for the record, my name is Lori Cremona Wagner.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead. Proceed.
Thank you. And my master's degree in civil engineering. I spent 20 years working in senior leadership positions in high tech, from Silicon Valley to Texas to Germany. And I've been a leader in marketing and process improvement as a master black belt and the owner of a business unit, a business within a business, with my top goal being margin. So there's no one that leads a tighter ship than me when it comes to wages, efficiency, and managing the bottom line. I'm now the VP of Business Insights and Performance Management at SAP, and I'm in charge of the efficiency and effectiveness of 2,000 marketeers and a $1 billion marketing budget. I live in Lake Oswego with my husband and my four children. And what I really wanted to do to illustrate the point today is to tell you a recent story to explain why I think this legislation is so important. It's a recent story. It's not at my current company. The company that I'm at today, I joined because of its focus on diversity and inclusion. It's actually one of our key performance indicators in terms of the percentage of women in management versus the percent of the women in marketing. But it is recent, and it was during an annual corporate-wide compensation review. So every year, every company that I've worked at in the last 20 years does a review of compensation. And the system provides us a view of each person, their level, and where they fall in the wage band compared to the median and compared to each other. One of my direct reports was the VP of sales, and he happened to have two managers of sales in the Americas whose territories were completely equal, the market opportunities equal, they were managing the same number of sales reps. In fact, the woman had actually performed better the past 2 years, and she at the time was getting paid 20% less in terms of total comp. But the recommendation that he gave me in terms of the allocation of the merit increase was to give all of the merit increase, the budget, to the man. And when I questioned him on this, and I said, well, why would you give the allocation to the man when clearly we have a big discrepancy to make up here? He said, he's the sole wage earner for his family. His wife doesn't work. He's the breadwinner. She's part of a dual income family. Her husband has a great job. She doesn't need the money as much. And I said, that's gender role bias. We're not going to stand for that here. And we talked about performance. We talked about what the merit increase was meant to be. And in fact, we were able to make up a large portion of the discrepancy with that merit increase that year. And the reason I tell you this story is because I was shocked that this mindset not only exists, but that someone thought that it was even okay to say this out loud. And the other reason I tell you this story is because I want to make sure to illustrate in small companies and large companies, we have systems in place to take care of this problem. So we have, you know, not only the systems in terms of HR systems, but we also have an annual process to review merit and to make changes to get people closer to where they need to be in terms of the median. So it wouldn't be hard to implement this. And in fact, it would be a really straightforward process to look at pay objectively and to make adjustments to bring people in line. The other thing that, from a corporate perspective, I really like about this bill is that it helps clarify what the rules are. We like rules. We like to understand what's expected when we're meeting the requirements, and I think this makes it really, really clear. And then from a personal standpoint, the comp history piece couldn't be more important. Not sharing your current comp is a basic tenet in negotiation. So any business school negotiation class you'll take says never share your current comp until they put a number on the table. And if that's a requirement before you get a job offer, you're pretty much putting yourself behind before you start. For a portion of my career, I was actually a single mother of a toddler and a preschooler. And I worked in a job share where I was paid 60% of a salary. When I went back to work full time and they asked me what my comp history was, I didn't put it on the application. And in fact, I was offered 100% of a full time salary and didn't have to explain the whole 60% thing. I was able to step back in. If it's a requirement, it not only enables, but it pretty much guarantees that the problem is perpetuated in terms of pay equity, pay inequity. So just to close, I just want to say that you might hear that systems will make this too hard, that it's a burden to companies, that now they won't want to hire women. And I'm here to tell you that this is going to make women want to come to companies, that what companies are going to be able to attract top talent, that this does happen every day. We need to do a lot more to make sure that we prevent it. And that, just like all of you, I want my children and my two girls to be able to reach their full potential based on merit and not on any other factor. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody have any questions? Okay. I just wanted to clarify about, probably for you, Whitney. So when one were to apply for a job, obviously some people are applying at all sorts of different levels. Some of them could be jobs that start just at the minimum wage level or they're up to $15 an hour or something like that, and different levels, some are hourly rates, salaries, etc. What would an employer be, can you talk us through a little bit about what they would be allowed to ask in any context at all, and would they ever know your previous salary, or how does that work?
So the well, first of all, that raises a good point that I want to make sure I make, is that an employer can take into account your experience. So you can ask, you know, how many years you've been working, and you can take that into account. The law has actually a relatively narrow prohibition. It says that you cannot ask the salary history of an employee from a current or former employer. So you're not allowed to ask them before you make the written offer what their previous salary history was. You are allowed, after you've made a written offer that includes the salary, to confirm what their salary was, or hourly rate. I'm using salary, but to your question, that would apply for a minimum wage or a salaried employee.
Okay, so after they were hired, I just want to make sure I understand. So I get hired at $15 an hour for a job.
Can I clarify?
Yeah.
It's not after they're hired.
After they're offered.
After the offer.
Okay,
right.
So I apply for a $15 an hour job. Mm-hmm. I don't share my salary history. Made that offer, and I used to work at X store, and you as the employer can call X store and say, I want to clarify that Taylor was actually your employee and made, you know, whatever, $14.50 an hour or $15 an hour or whatever, and then they can find out at that point.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Would an employer be, changing subjects slightly, would an employer be allowed to ask, what are you hoping to make?
Yes, absolutely. You can ask for a preferred salary,
okay.
And you can negotiate salary. So you can have a conversation. It's not saying you can't talk about salary.
Well, I'm bringing this up. I want to have this on the record about what is allowed in the interview process about anything to do with compensation.
Right.
Can you ask things such, so I'm going to let you answer the question, but I also want you to factor in things like, can they say, what was the bonus structure of where you once worked? Meaning that were you paid 100% on commission, or were you paid, mm-hmm. because some of these employers, the compensation looks very different, you know, as a labor lawyer. I mean, at one point in my life as an individual, I worked at a 100% commission. And so, and how that structure was, I just want to talk a little bit about, because there's all these different ways in which people are compensated. So,
absolutely. So those are very good questions. And I go back to the fact that this law doesn't prevent you from having discussions about compensation.
Okay, so walk
at
us
all.
Through that. Okay.
So you can ask what, how you were paid. Absolutely. You could have that conversation about were you hourly? Were you salaried? Were you receiving bonuses? Were you receiving commission? What the percentages of those were? That's your pay structure. Mm-hmm. And the very narrow prohibition here is the exact amount of salary that you were receiving. And salary, that would include the amount of your bonus and the amount of your, so you couldn't say, let's say you were paid based on commission. You don't get to do an end run around how much they were paid by asking their commission and not their salary, but you could ask anything else about how they're paid, what they believe the market rate is, what they want, what their preferences are. You can have that conversation. And again, you can have the conversation after you make the offer and you know what you can confirm their salary. You could then have more specific conversations if there's concerns that develop for one reason or another, if the offer is too high or too low. You could then, at that point, have specific conversations.
Okay, that's an important point that I'd like you to go into more detail about. So let's say that I apply, and then all of a sudden, you've offered me the job at $20 an hour or something, and it turned out I only made $15 an hour in my previous job. And then you say, well, wait a minute, and then it's offered. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And then you call and say, well, it turns out Taylor only made $15 an hour, so now I actually want to lower the offer. Would that be allowed?
Well, I think that probably wouldn't be very practical, but
I'm just wondering,
nothing in the law that would prevent you from lowering your offer.
Okay.
But I would have concerns about doing that because you would want to know.
I'm not advocating for that. I'm just clarifying
why you would want to do that. But sure, you could lower the offer. The law doesn't prevent you from doing that. But you would want to. The employee would need to make sure that the reason they're lowering the offer is not based on their existence in a protected category.
Okay.
And so my concern in that situation is that if you have somebody leaving a job that was low paid because of their gender, for example, mm-hmm. and they go into a new job and you've determined that $20 an hour is the correct pay for that job. You find out they were only making $15 and you want to lower your offer. The employer would need to make sure that they're not lowering their offer because that person is because of their gender.
Okay, yeah, no, just because you are a labor lawyer and I wanted to ask a clarifying question. And then regarding, let's say you work in a job where sales are an indicator of your success. So you sell cars. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm making this up. But they say, well, how many, what was your net sales for the year? And you would say, well, I sold $400,000 worth of cars or something like that. I mean, would an employer be able to ask basically trying to get at how successful you were at selling whatever it is that you're selling?
Yeah. Absolutely. That's another great question. Definitely. You can definitely ask about their performance. That's a question about their performance, right? And mm-hmm. what type of work were they doing, how much the volume of work they're doing, anything related to that.
Okay, including the dollar amount of the item sold, not just that I sold 50 cars, but I sold whatever, $400,000. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can actually ask the dollar amount of the sales yielded. So in software sales or something like that, you could ask that question.
Yes, you can have those conversations about the type of work they perform, their performance, and any of those factors that you're raising.
Okay.
I don't see any reason why this law would prevent an employer from discussing that.
Okay, I just wanted to have that on the record. Does anybody have any questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. And so we're going to go ahead and call up Betsy Earls from AOI, Piper Sweeney, and Juanita Lint. Okay, who is Piper Sweeney? Okay, in full disclosure, my maiden name is Sweeney.
Really?
And now middle name, and so I'm a little bit biased here towards
great
already,
name.
You know, because it's a fabulous name.
Right.
Fabulous name. Okay, well, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and Oregon Business Association. As you probably heard by now, AOI and OBA are in the process of a merger, so when one of our lobbyists speaks before a committee, we're effectively representing both organizations. AOI and OBA and our 1,600 members unequivocally support the principle of equal pay for equal work. We support the federal and state laws that protect fair compensation. We believe that the best long-term strategy to achieve pay equity in the workplace is to ensure that all workers possess the education and skills that will allow our enterprises to succeed in an increasingly complex global economy. That said, we do have some concerns about the bill that is before you today. And again, I want to be very clear that this testimony and commentary should in no way reflect our position on the concept of equal pay and pay equity and how important that is to our organizations and to our members. But the bill before us does pose significant problems for the Oregon business community, and we wanted to go through some of those technicalities. I will go through the technicalities with you, and then I will let Piper and Juanita talk with you a little bit about how the bill would impact their own businesses and the work that they do. Before we start, and I think it's been pointed out to you already, under current law, any member of a protected class who alleges pay discrimination right now can get relief today under ORS 659A030, either in civil court or through Boley's Civil Rights Division. So we are not in a situation right now in Oregon where a complainant would only have an administrative remedy. There's already civil remedies where they can take their employer to court, and they have that option. They have two options right there. I think our biggest concern about this bill is the way it shifts the burden of proof from the complainant, the person that is bringing the complaint in court, to the defendant. Employer liability for wage discrimination in Oregon requires the complainant to prove discriminatory motivation under current law. The person that's bringing the lawsuit needs to prove that there was motivation on the part of the employer to discriminate, that they intended to discriminate. But House Bill 2005 creates a type of strict liability that requires no showing of intent to discriminate on the part of the employer. An employee would only have to prove two elements. They would have to prove that they were performing work that was comparable to that of coworkers of different genders, races, protected classes, and that they were paid less than those other workers. Once the employee had been able to show that, the burden of proof was then on the employer to show that the difference in wages, they would be liable for the difference in wages unless they could prove that the pay disparity was based on a factor other than the protected class status. The absence of discriminatory motivation would not be a defense to a claim in Oregon in the same way it is right now or under our current employment discrimination statutes. And that's a big concern for us. It's a big liability shift. Furthermore, once an employer took that burden on, the burden to prove that they were relying on a bona fide factor other than that protected class status as a defense to the purported pay differential is so stringent in this bill that it would be nearly impossible for them to meet. The burden would be met only if the employer could demonstrate that the pay inequity was not based on or derived from the protected class status, which makes sense and is current law, but also that it would be that it's not based on perceptions of traditional or gender appropriate roles, is job related to the position in question and is based on business necessity, and that those reasons account for the entire compensation differential. So we have in this one paragraph, we have some very vague terms that would be difficult to prove, and then some others that require very specific accounting, as I said, accounting for the entire compensation differential. And I think that sets up kind of a no-win situation for an employer who is already carrying the burden of proof in court. In Section 3, the pay history section, that's already been obviously extensively discussed here. And I think that the proffered reason for this amendment is to reduce gender-based or other protected status-based pay disparity, but it goes well beyond that, the way it's written. The way the bill is written, it prohibits an employer from considering prior compensation for any employee, regardless of their protected class status. And that's a pretty big leap. Many employers ask prospective employees about their prior pay for legitimate reasons, and one of those in particular is that they want to determine the likelihood that an employee that they very much want, if hired, is going to remain with the new employer. I've had in my own experience situations where employees have wanted to work in Salem or have wanted to take a job, believe it or not, at a lobbying organization, and have been willing to take a lower salary than perhaps was really realistic for them. And under this bill, and, you know, so that turns out not to be a good fit on a long-term basis and that kind of thing, especially if you're dealing with your own family, you're the person that took the lower salary. That kind of thing leads to kind of a long-term situation that doesn't have an upside. And in our situation, the person ended up leaving. And it was mostly because of the pay differential that they originally thought was going to be fine because they honestly so much wanted to work for a lobby organization. And then it just didn't turn out to be the right thing. And under this bill, we wouldn't be allowed to inquire about their pay history at all. So that would completely close off an avenue of inquiry that I think is extremely worthwhile for a lot of employers when they're trying to look at all the factors that determine fit and whether you're hiring somebody that's going to work out well, not only for your organization, but for the employee and their family and, you know, kind of the long term. So that's our main concern about pay history. The last thing I'll bring up with you is the statute of limitations, Section 3, Sub 5. Because the bill states that it's an unlawful compensation practice occurs every time an employee is paid pursuant to a discriminatory decision or practice, the practical effect is that every single time an employee gets a paycheck, if there is an alleged discriminatory practice, that is a separate unlawful employment practice and leads to a separate liability. So that's a problem. The other problem there, of course, is the unwary employer could end up with liability that extends into the past that they had not expected, planned for, or otherwise realized was hovering out there in the future for them. I think that's my testimony for now. And
okay, thank you. I just want to ask a clarifying question. I was a little bit confused about when you were talking about the example that you were giving about giving the lower salary, mm-hmm. and we'll have someone come and clarify later. Elsie, I know, is very busy, but we'll hopefully have time to come down a little bit later. But let's clarify that about the I don't think that the bill prohibits someone from taking the job if they choose to take the job.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. So I just wanted to understand, maybe you can, I was a little confused in the example. Maybe you can explain to me. You weren't implying that the person couldn't take the job for the lower amount.
No.
Okay. All right.
No.
So maybe I missed it. I want to make certain that I definitely understand what was I supposed to learn from the story?
Okay. And I'm sorry, I was probably not terribly clear.
No, it's okay. Yeah.
Madam Chair, the problem that I see under the bill is not that the person couldn't take the job. They absolutely could take the job, and they could, if we asked them what their preferred salary was, they obviously wouldn't be prevented from saying something that they thought was appropriate, which might be higher or lower or whatever. The problem that I see under the bill as it's written right now is that we couldn't even ask what their salary history was.
Okay, so that you objected that even though the person, you could ask, what is your preferred salary?
Sure.
All right.
We did.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All right. We did ask that, and we could ask that under the bill. The problem is if you're not able to ask what somebody's salary history is, you can end up in a situation where we were aware they were, their preferred salary was something that was probably not preferred because it wasn't what they'd been making before, mm-hmm. and they were willing to take a job at a lower pay. I think they were probably expecting that their pay would increase more quickly as they, you know, they went through their time at our office, and it didn't. And because we didn't know that, we didn't really have that one avenue for determining whether it was a good fit for that employee or not, and whether their expectations about salary increase in the future were realistic.
Okay. All right. And then, of course, I think just to remind everybody, I believe the bill allows that once the offer is made, then you can go back and find out what their past salary was. Okay. Well, thank you. That was very informative. Well, that's we obviously are interested in working to, you know, talking with you more about the details of the bill. So definitely want to do that. So hello, Ms. Sweeney, a name I don't get to say very often. So I'm glad you're here. What are you here to tell us today?
Okay. Well, I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Piper Sweeney, and I farm with my husband out in Dayton. So we have a small, medium-sized, I'd say, family farm. And I want to say first off, I have no issues with pay equity. It's very important not fighting that in any way. But what concerns me on this bill is that the appearance of inequity isn't necessarily inequity. And my example is I have two employees. I have Jorge and Hank, and they do essentially the same job. I mean, on a farm, you kind of do whatever comes up. But they're around, you know, the same tasks that we ask them to do. Jorge is efficient. He is very hardworking. If there's time to stand around, he's sweeping the floor. He's cleaning up, you know, what he sees laying around. He's just a very hard worker. Hank is a great guy. He does a pretty good job. He's probably going to be leaning up against something. He's probably, when there's waiting time, he's not looking for something to do. So there's a real difference what they bring to the table. So my concern is, in this case, that works out great. Hank is in a protected class, so there really wouldn't be an issue under this. However, if the roles were reversed, so now Jorge is the guy that's probably going to be standing around, and Hank's the guy that will get up and push the broom and everything. My concern is, so there's a perceived inequity. Let's say now Jorge is feeling like he's not getting paid enough because he's not making as much as Hank is. So if I have to take that to court, I think that I'll win. I'm not concerned about being able to prove there, you know, we don't discriminate, and I wouldn't be worried about proving it. What I'm worried about is the cost to me, because that might look to Jorge that he's not getting paid equally for equal work, when yes, I can defend that, but now I have to go and pay. I have to take the time. I think it's just too easy to get into a lawsuit. I'm paying dollars out to prove that I did it right, and that concerns me, especially in a small business. Another example real quick is that we, this past summer, we had a young lady who came back after she had worked a few years ago, a senior in high school. We do Marion Berry's at night. It's not a great, you know, it's not a fun job to sort of switch your whole schedule, and for a month you don't get any days off, and you have to sleep all day and work all night. So she kind of had come and took a couple years off and then came back. She was in college and needed money. And, you know, so then she's like, okay, I'm willing to do that job, which is our experience for a lot of young people. But anyway, I also had some young men who worked consecutive years. And so they had been promoted to driver. And so my daughter asked one year, why wouldn't have any women drivers? And so I thought about that, and I thought, you know, I don't know, are we not, you know, promoting? And so we kind of talked about it and thought about, like, okay, what's happened? Well, about, I'm thinking probably 10 years past, we'd had all women drivers. And it just so happened we were in a, you know, sort of a 10-year period where the guys were working consecutive years, and some of the women were either coming just 1 year or they'd come back, but they would have these, you know, spaces in between. Well, you don't remember when you only do something for 1 month out of the summer, you do it once a year. You don't remember all the things you've got to think about when you're driving that berry picker, you know, what are the things that go into it. So it just so happened we had guys for that period of time. And so again, I think if it push came to shove and I was in, you know, had to prove it, I think I'd have an easy case because, it was experience. There were reasons for it. But looking at it from maybe this young gal's perspective is like, well, wait a minute, I worked here before too, and I haven't gotten a chance to drive. So And then if she chose, well, I want to pursue this, then I'm in, again, in a position where, yes, I can defend myself, but it's going to cost money and time. And I'm a small business owner. You know, I don't have human resource person. I don't, you know, I do the payroll, I do the accounting, I do the personnel. And so those are the things that concern me on this bill, is that I'm, you know, I may find myself defending myself for things that I did not do wrong, but it's going to cost me time and money. And okay. So that's my concern.
All right. Well, thank you for coming. Hello.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Taylor, and members of the committee for letting me to come here and testify today. I'm Juanita Lint, and I'm the owner with my husband of Plum Hill Vineyards out in Gaston, Oregon. I have a degree in computer science engineering, which was rare for anybody in my generation, but particularly for a woman. In fact, I was the only woman to be in my class at OIT after the first semester. My professional career included 22 years of large-scale project management in highly technical fields, utilizing my master's degree in technology management. During that career, I managed several large teams and projects as large as $30 million. For the majority of my career, I was paid more than my male counterparts. In fact, I was paid the most at my level in my department, sometimes more than my bosses. In 2000, I took an early retirement and started up a retail craft bazaar business and began my winery career by assisting other wineries. In 2007, my husband and I created a boutique vineyard and winery, Plum Hill Vineyards, including grape production, wine processing, marketing, and agritourism. I'm here today to testify in opposition of Senate Bill 752, which would make it an unlawful employment practice to screen job applicants based on salary history, to base salary decisions on salary history, and to seek salary history information from a job applicant until after making a job offer. This policy change would lump these standard job screening procedures into categories of wage-related offenses that include rights to a jury trial, the result of which could result in compensatory and punitive damages. In my professional career, before becoming a small business owner myself, I was able to negotiate a higher salary for myself during the interview process on multiple occasions. And I suspect that salary was even higher than some of the men in similar positions. I'm concerned that this bill would discourage women from asking for a higher salary and prohibit employers from offering a higher salary to applicants for fear of being sued by current, former, or other prospective employees. In fact, I most likely would not have been offered some of the positions and salary that I required. As an employer, I'm concerned that I would be forced to enact strict and rigid salary policies with no room for flexibility, and that in some circumstances I would not be able to adequately match the right person with the right job. Currently, our top two employees are women, one of whom reports to my husband. Aside from the fact that every time the legislator acts to make lawsuits against employers more prevalent, it creates a chilling effect on small business creation, I'm here today to share with you my personal views as a woman who worked for over two decades in a field made up by a majority of men, and as a woman who now owns a business and is responsible for finding the right people to fill the positions that our business needs to run smoothly. SB 752 would prohibit screening job applicants based on current or past compensation. Determining compensation for a position based on current or past compensation of a prospective employee or current employee, and seeking the salary history of an applicant or employee from a current or former employee unless the employer has already made a job offer that includes the compensation. I'm not aware of any business that thinks discriminating against a woman is okay, and this bill will do little to prevent the discrimination examples expressed today. I want to point out that women are business owners too, not just employees, and this bill is just as likely to put a woman-owned business on the defensive as a business owned by a man. Again, on behalf of the thousands of small businesses in Oregon who are already following the law, especially small businesses owned by a woman, I ask you to oppose Senate Bill 752. Thank you for letting me testify today.
Okay. Okay, thank you all for coming. Does anyone have any questions? Okay, thank you. We'll go ahead and we'll call up. We have, let's see, Trish Garner, come on up, and Nikki, Nikki Fisher and Trish. And then after that, we'll have Amanda and James Barta after that. Okay, we have to be a little bit sensitive to time here.
Right.
So
I'll do my best.
Okay.
Chair Taylor and members of the committee, my name is Trish Garner. I'm here on behalf of the American Association of University Women. And I'm going to dip just a tad into statistics, but I just want to tell you that I have a personal experience that has some relevance here. I used to practice law as an attorney. As a matter of fact, I was a criminal trial attorney. For some of my career, I was a federal prosecutor, also clerk for a federal district court judge. But my primary career was devoted to criminal defense work. And I had completed some 2.5 week trial. It was in federal court. It was after months and months of investigations and witness interviews and so on and so on. And as a court-appointed attorney, I submitted my bill to the judge. And in open court, the judge, with a great smile, said, "Well, you know, you did some wonderful work here. We really appreciate it. But because you're married to a physician, I'm going to have to, you know, take 50% of your pay off." So my bill, which was, you know, as legitimate as it can be as a trial attorney, the judge felt he could just half the bill without further ado. So that is an example, and I could cite some others, but one that certainly rankled me and has stayed with me through all these years. I think there are some people who really don't think that there's a pay gap, but unfortunately it exists. It starts early. It continues and sometimes even gets worse as it continues. If we focus on college graduates, just 1 year after graduation, women were paid 82% of what their similarly educated and experienced male counterparts were paid. 10 years after, the gap widened and it's 69%, even though the women were more likely to get some advanced education. This gap still maintained. And while this may be a statistical litany that may hopefully not make you glaze over and cause me to go over my time, but so many times I hear, well, you know, it's due to other factors, social factors, choice, et cetera. But in the study that's talking about the earnings of male and female college graduates 1 year after graduation, this study accounted for the following factors: college major, occupation, economic sector, hours worked, months unemployed since graduation, grade point average, type of graduate institution, institution selectivity, age, geographical region, and marital status. After accounting for all of that in that population, there was still at least a 7% wage gap between the salaries of men and women. I think one of the interesting things also about the wage gap is it has a tendency to hit the hardest at the lowest levels and the highest levels of women wage earners. It also is interesting to me that women who enter into what's traditionally a male-dominated field, well, guess what? The salaries in that field go down. To the extent that we think all women in Oregon earn approximately the same rate or have the same statistical effect, there's a study that shows in 2014 in the Northwest Oregon, which is Clatsop, Columbia, and Tillamook counties, obviously non-metro, more rural counties, women's earnings were half of men statewide. They were 76% of all Oregon women's earnings and 64% of their fellow Northwest Oregon men's earnings. So there's a difference, and perhaps it's even more profound in non-metropolitan areas. Women who are mothers encounter what's often called the motherhood penalty, but I think what's often misunderstood is that penalty exists and compounds as time continues. It doesn't go away. One can't, get back what one had before. It's also interesting that mothers, again, who hold full-time year-round jobs are paid 71 cents on the dollar. Fathers usually receive a wage increase, a premium, when they are fathers. Mothers who are also women of color can face what's called a sex plus bias. Now, I have some examples for you.
I have to be sensitive to time because we only have a little bit more, and we have three more people after you, and we want to have time for Elsie and Bully to come up if needed. So,
The compounding happens as women approach retirement. They understand that they have been discriminated against. That's why the language with respect to the statute of limitations is in the statute. In other words, it's not just 1 year of back pay, but if they've been with the same employer year after year after year, and, for example, come to retirement and realize they have been losing and compounding year after year, then they need to be able to recover that money.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay, Nikki.
Thank you, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. My name is Nikki Fisher, and I'm the commissioner for the Oregon Commission for Women. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of SB 752. The Oregon Commission for Women is a strong supporter of this legislation as it believes equal pay for equal work is essential here in Oregon. We know how critical equal pay legislation is to Oregon and Oregon families. We know the effect of this legislation will have impacts across age, location, disability status, income, religious affiliation, sexuality, gender identity, citizenship status, and primary language. Pay disparities among African American women is 63 cents to every dollar a white man makes. For Latino Oregonians, it's only 54 cents. These striking disparities have critical impacts on Oregon communities of color. The most recent report by the Oregon Women's Foundation, Counterin, highlights how critical the need for equal pay legislation will be. The report highlights the most urgent issues impacting women in the state of Oregon, with pay equity as one of the most critical for Oregon families. The wage gap hurts women and their families with each paycheck and results in lower retirement savings and less wealth to pass on to the next generation. Counterin reports that women tend to be in jobs with unpredictable or irregular scheduling, which leaves them in chronic, part-time, lower-paying jobs. The gender and race wealth gap in Oregon is created and perpetuated by discrimination, wage gaps, varied workforce participation, a lack of equitable opportunities, disproportionate criminal justice involvement, and unaffordable caregiving. The Oregon Commission for Women, working towards equity for children, women and children, applaud the champions of this legislation for introducing fair, equitable practices that will make a solid impact in Oregon. We commissioners believe that this is an urgent matter and support systemic practices to close the pay gap for all working Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm going to take, I know we had two more.
I have a question.
Oh, yeah, I'm so sorry.
That's right.
Senator Hansel.
I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Trish Garner, sir.
Trish, yes. You said all these years later it still rankles you, your
yes.
illustration. Well, it would rankle me, too, I understand. But do you think if you submitted your bill today, due to the changes in federal and state law, that you would get the same response from the judge?
I would certainly state that the judge would not state it in open court. I think that there are further regulations, and indeed, just exactly what this statute's trying to do is to make it clear. If you do this work, you get paid this amount for your hourly rate. This statute is designed to do that. If you work comparably, you get paid the same. So given the fact that now that all has to be clear, in other words, If you earn the money as an attorney, I'm not saying this very well, if you put in your hours worked, you get paid that. It's a total public, transparent procedure. It would not happen
today. I understand
today.
That, but if we don't have that law, if you submitted your bill right now, with the federal and state laws that are in place, do you feel that your bill would be cut in half as the judge did before?
To tell you the truth, I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions? Okay, thank you. Oh, okay, thank you for coming. Okay. I appreciate that. We're going to go ahead and I want to make certain, I know I had asked for Amanda and James to be on standby, but since we have LC here and we have Paloma from Boley, does anyone have any questions for LC or for Paloma?
Yes.
Yes, okay, great. So, Gail and Paloma, can you come forward, please? And then hopefully we'll have enough time to hear from James Gard-Mambarda and Amanda. And if we don't, then we can talk about that, hold you over for next time, or you can submit written testimony. But let's see how much time we end up having. So, okay. Hi, why don't you go? Who should we? Why don't you both introduce yourselves, get your names on the record, and then we can ask questions.
Gail Stevens from the Office of Legislative Counsel.
For the record, Paloma Sparks from the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
Okay, great, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gail, so we have laws on the books today that currently prohibit discrimination based on gender as it relates to pay. Is that correct?
Chair Taylor, Senator Canope, that is correct. We do. We have laws that prohibit discrimination based on protected classes, not based on salary discrepancies, though.
And follow up?
Yes.
And what are those protected classes?
Chair Taylor, Senator Canope, it depends on the law, but I believe you're referring to laws similar to Title VII or 659A030, which is modeled after Title VII. Race, national origin, color, religion, sex, and age.
Okay.
Go ahead,
Senator. Thank you. Madam Chair, so Paloma, how many complaints or cases do you have currently as it relates to wage discrimination or pay inequity today in Boley?
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope, we don't, because there's no explicit protection for discrimination based on pay other than the existing wage and hour statute, and the wage and hour division isn't really suited for evaluating discrimination. Those complaints are investigated under by civil rights under sex discrimination claims. As I've been told, most of those complaints involve an element of pay discrimination. We receive about 300 to 400 sex discrimination complaints a year. It's about 25% of the complaints we receive.
Follow up?
Yes, Senator.
So you said 300 to 400. So of those 300 or 400, you're suggesting that the majority of those have elements of pay discrimination based on sex in the complaint?
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope, most of those complaints have alleged an element of also pay discrimination.
Okay.
Does anyone want to ask any clarifying questions? Since we have LC, she drafted the bill, so this is our time to, I mean, of course we can have her back another time, but okay. And so, well, thank you both for coming. Appreciate that. Thank you. And so we'll probably have you come back another time, but as we move along. But for right now, that's great. And then we're going to have Senator Gelser. Did you want to talk a little bit about the bill?
I think Amanda is here, and she needs to leave okay. by 4:30.
Okay, great. So let's go ahead and have Amanda come up and James Barta, please. Okay, why don't we have you go first then?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name's Amanda Monjadas, and I'm the Advocacy Director for the Coalition of Communities of Color. The Coalition is an alliance of 19 culturally specific community-based organizations with representation from the African-American, Latino, African, Asian Pacific Islander, Native American, Slavic, immigrant, and refugee communities. And our mission is to advance racial equity in this state. We also produce community-based research in Multnomah County, are currently working in other counties, including Washington County. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill, in support of Senate Bill 752. We often hear about pay inequality between men and women. We've heard a lot of data today and a lot of great stories. And I just want to highlight the disparities that are more severe within communities of color, particularly for women of color. I'm going to repeat some of the data you've already heard. But we know while women in Oregon are earning 80 cents on the dollar, that number is 75 cents for Asian women, 63 cents for African women, and just over 50 cents for Latino women. Based on our own research we've done in Multnomah County, we see that communities of color and families of color are earning half the median income of white families, and we believe it's unacceptable and shouldn't be explained away with stereotypes around education and occupation choice. We know that people of color already face too many institutional barriers to better outcomes and opportunities. And based on some of the testimony that happened before, it seems to us that a clear policy will actually create more transparency for employees so that they don't feel like they're being treated differently in certain businesses. So we believe that this bill is a step in the right direction towards providing necessary protections to ensure that every worker, woman, and person of color is measured by the quality of their work and not the color of their skin. That's why we're asking you to join us in support of Senate Bill 752, a bill that we believe will promote economic security for all families in a very insecure and difficult time for many of our communities. Thank you.
Mr. Barta.
Chair Taylor, it's a pleasure to be here, members of the committee. My name is James Barta. I'm the Legislative Director for Children First for Oregon, working to make Oregon the best place to be a kid. And this is a children's issue as well, whether we like it or not. Some of the data about households in the state with children, there's some 400,000 overall, but 22% of them, 93,000 households, are led by a single woman. A single mother. And as a comparison, about 9.1% of those households with children are led by a single father. But when you take that 22% and add on, among other households with children, about 15%, the main breadwinner is the mother, you're looking at an issue where children are directly affected by this pay equity problem that Oregon women face, and as you've heard data from around the country, they also face. And it's such an issue that it's on our children's agenda, as many of you have seen, that many organizations are supportive of the concept. You know, it's not just some of the ones you've seen testify here, but nurses and the labor union and in other places. And so we recognize this issue as something that will help children, because part of the problem is that the poverty rate for female headed households with children is 41%. And if you compare the poverty rate for male-headed households, again, these are single-parent households, the poverty rate is 22.6%. Those are national figures. And so I think everyone recognizes that there's pay equity as a problem. Trish Garner has, I noticed, already many research reports submitted as written testimony that are found on all this. We could talk about the data till the cows come home. I think people, though, from the stories can recognize that this is an issue that we need to face. And it's one that, if it's in law but without remedy, it's something that we need to remedy as a legislature. So I hope you'll support the work on Senate Bill 752, and we'll continue to work with you all.
Great. Any questions? All right. Well, thank you so much for coming. We appreciate it. Okay. So, Senator Gelser.
Well, thank you. I don't have to say who I am since I'm right here, right?
I don't know. Ask Debbie. What are the rules? Probably go ahead and say who you are.
Okay. Well, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm a member of this committee, and I represent Senate District 8, and just grateful for the hearing today and all of the great testimony. There isn't a lot to add except for that I would really like to thank the chief proponents of the bill for accepting a friendly amendment to add disability into the protected class category, which is just makes sense and is very important to a lot of people in the state of Oregon. So I'm looking forward to working on the bill, getting it ready to go, and thank you, Representative Linear and Senator Taylor, for bringing it forward.
Okay, great. I think I missed one. Thank you. I think I missed one person. Is Claire Berger here?
She had a leave.
Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. We had several people sign up here. So any other questions? And if anyone had any, yes, you want to talk to?
Looks like she wants to testify.
Okay, great. Thank you. Oh, I'm so sorry. I apologize.
That's okay.
The Chair Taylor and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, and like other women's organizations, we're fully behind Senate Bill 752. I think there are a few provisions in there that really will help, not only on the fair pay, but on just women achieving equity in finances. There are long-term consequences when women are paid less than men, and so I'll bring up one of my suggested long-term consequences. When a woman is older and she goes on Medicare, she can sometimes become what's called a dual eligible, and that means that our Medicaid dollars pay for her Medicare and pay for oftentimes the co-pays. In Oregon, 70% of the women, 70% of the dual eligibles on Medicare and Medicaid are women, if it's over 65. We spend $1.5 billion on dual eligibles in the state of Oregon, the last figures that I could find with, I think they were 2011, because they've been not keeping figures quite as much. But that's a fair chunk of change. And when you think that probably somewhere between 60 to 70% of that spending is on women, and if women made more money and had more better retirement benefits, they would maybe not have to be going on dual eligible, having us pay their Medicaid and their Medicare as well. So long-term consequences down the road, hopefully this will bend that cost curve.
Okay, what an excellent point. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming. Okay, so that brings us to the end of our testimony. This is obviously our first hearing on this issue. We'll be talking about it more. So we'll have folks come that we've heard both sides of this, and so we'll be working with folks to see what we can do to move the pay equity bill forward. So, all right.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
In a future hearing, could we possibly hear, and I was out for a bit, so maybe you discuss this, but what other states are doing and how that, if they have laws that are more advanced than Oregon, mm-hmm. What the outcomes of those laws have been in other states that maybe have moved in this direction.
Sure. I guess Elsie already left. She did do some of the preliminary work, but yes, we will have that done. She did some work on that. She was able to walk us through some of the bills in other states, but I don't know that she did a thorough analysis. I think it was more that I asked the question in general, but I think that that's a great question, and let's talk about that. I know in Massachusetts and Minnesota, is that what she said, were two states where it's gone through, other states have bills that it's kind of an active topic across the country. Mm-hmm. So it's a good idea that we should find out what's going on elsewhere. Okay, thank you everyone for coming. I'm going to go ahead and close public hearing on Senate Bill 752. Our next meeting is on Monday, February 27th. We'll have a public hearing on Senate Bill 828 concerning fair work week predictive schedules. Go ahead and adjourn the meeting on Senate Work Committee on Workforce. Committee on Workforce.